This is CJSF 90.1 FM, and you're tuning into our super summer programming. I'm Hallelujah.
And I'm Stella. And together, we'll be highlighting the queer community, environmental issues, and upcoming local events.
Stay tuned for interviews, discussion, and music from our collections.
Burnaby is located on the ancestral and stolen territories of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples, the lands that they have cared for since time immemorial. Today, I'm here with Clea, the Director of Operations at the Still Moon Arts Society. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners and just tell them a little bit about you?
Sure. My name is Clea. I've been with Still Moon Arts Society for a little over 3 years. And my background is in both community organizing and also in ecology. So previous to this job, I worked at the Pacific Salmon Foundation, which was a wonderful way to get to know more about salmon and a great organization. And also a lot longer ago than that, I was one of the founding directors of SFU's Graduate Student Society. So I also have a background in bringing people together.
Okay, cool. I didn't know there was a little SFU connection there. That's nice. Starting off for some context, what does the Still Moon Arts Society do in and for the Vancouver community, especially in Still Creek?
Well, we're based, like you said, around the Still Creek watershed. It's Vancouver portion, and that is also the Renfrew-Collingwood neighborhood. They coincide almost perfectly. For those who aren't familiar, Renfrew-Collingwood is in East Vancouver, kind of stretching between Renfrew and Rupert SkyTrain station down to Joyce station. So what we do in the community there is sort of three strands that we weave together through different activities. The first strand is community. So we do work to bring together people in the neighborhood and beyond, help people get to know new people in their community and work together. The kind of activities we do that through are art and environmental stewardship. The second strand is art. So we make community-based art, where we engage community in making large projects together, and we also just teach and share art skills with each other. The third strand is nature. So a lot of our work goes towards both helping restore Still Creek and the Renfrew Ravine, which it flows through, and also to drawing people's attention to nature, helping them kind of notice it in a way they might not otherwise, and appreciate and enjoy its beauty. So a lot of the art we do is specifically focused to draw attention to nature or using natural materials.
Nice. That's lovely. Do you think you could speak a little bit more to the importance of improving green spaces within the city where, you know, local community can gather?
Absolutely. So green spaces are one of the things that make or break a city in terms of its livability. Vancouver and Burnaby, where SFU is, of course, has some really gorgeous green spaces like Stanley Park or Burnaby Lake in Burnaby, or, you know, even up at SFU, Burnaby Mountain is lovely. But we also have large parts of the city that are paved and lack trees or green spaces. And of course, as neighborhoods densify, as more people move to the city and we replace single family homes with condos and high rises, that puts more pressure on those natural spaces. And, you know, people have a kind of harder time having time in nature. And also, as climate change progresses, it also kind of becomes more important, because a lot of these green spaces also provide mitigation and protection against climate change. So in heavily paved areas where there isn't a lot of tree cover, you get heat island effect, where the concrete absorbs heat and magnifies it, so that the temperature in highly paved areas is usually several degrees warmer than in areas with green spaces in close proximity. Another thing we see that makes green spaces, and especially green spaces connected to creek systems, important is with climate change, we see increased flooding and droughts, and how water is managed going into both where it falls on the ground as rainwater, and also kind of how quickly it flows through the system or how slowly it moves through the system. makes a big difference to whether we see kind of flooding and droughts or whether the ground can kind of act as a bank for water. Some people use the phrase sponge city, which I really like, which kind of describes the ground being a sponge that can hold water and then release it over time. So there's a lot of things we can do in stewarding our green spaces that improve life for people who live in the city, both in terms of the beauty and relaxation that comes with being in green spaces and enjoying nature, but also well-being in terms of protection against heat and flood and that sort of thing. And I know that there's some really gorgeous big parks in Vancouver. The one we focus on, Renfrew Ravine Park, is actually one that's lesser known. It is one of Vancouver's significant urban forests, but it's hidden away in East Vancouver, and a lot of people don't realize it's there. So it's this beautiful little jewel surrounded by a neighborhood which is much more heavily paved than a lot of areas in the city. So we're really kind of fortunate in a neighborhood that it does have so much paved areas that we also have this little oasis in the middle that people can get away to. Well, I'll also mention that Still Creek, that a lot of our work centers around, is very unusual in Vancouver because it's one of very few of the original creeks in Vancouver that was never fully paved over and brought underground. Vancouver used to be full of bogs, swamps, rivers, creeks that were full of beavers, fish, and the landscape was really different across the city. Over time, as cities got developed, most of the creeks were brought underground into the sewer system. You know, at the time, that did help protect people from some of the diseases that could be caught through, you know, untreated sewage, but it also meant that we lost a lot of those beautiful places, and we also lost a lot of the water management that they provided, which is why we now have problems with flooding. And especially as the city grows more dense and more water is getting used, and there's less and less space for water to flow over land, the problem with drought and flooding are getting worse. So we're lucky in Still Creek that we have this stretch of river that was never buried underground. And we're also doubly lucky because it's one of the only few remaining salmon streams left in Vancouver. I think there's only about five. Most of them are at the edges of the city, such as around Kits, you know, around UBC. I think there's a couple. But we are the only one that is located centrally in a heavily urbanized area. And the salmon were actually gone from the creek, from the Vancouver portion of the creek, for over 80 years. And in 2012, they started coming back to an area behind the Canadian Tire there by Rupert SkyTrain station. And it was a really uplifting moment, I think, for a lot of people who work on environmental issues, because people had said that the creek was too heavily polluted, that salmon would never come back there. But they did. And a lot of people worked hard to restore the creek leading up to that. And there was also some infrastructure change, putting in kind of some infrastructure in under the highway that helped the fish swim through the long pipe there from underground that goes under Boundary Road. But to see that the fish would actually come back and come back year after year and spawn in, you know, a very heavily urbanized part of Vancouver was really encouraging for people who work on these issues. You know, if you give nature a little bit of a helping hand, often things can actually heal and improve. So we feel very fortunate to be working on a creek that has salmon in it in the middle of the city.
Yeah, that is a very nice piece of hope for sure in the face of the climate crisis that, you know, we can come back from pollution and certain other problems. And I know you mentioned that the Renfrew Ravine was transformed, and that must have been a massive project. And I was wondering what the motivation was behind that.
Well, our organization was started by Carmen Rosine, an artist who moved into the neighborhood just a few blocks from the ravine over 20 years ago. And as she was exploring her new neighborhood, she came upon the ravine and saw what a beautiful, wild place it was. But it was also full of garbage. It was one of those many places that people kind of dump their construction waste and or their home garbage if they don't want to have to take it to a dump or pay fees. So it was very polluted. There were several, I think there was at least one car down there who someone had driven into the ravine at some point. Just lots and lots of garbage. So she wasn't the first to work on cleaning up the ravine. She kind of joined in a group of local residents who were already trying to clean it up. But what she did was try and put some momentum through bringing art to the community and kind of organizing people to come together around uplifting, joyful events with celebration and art and music and food to make a difference to the ravine. So originally they were hauling many dumpsters of garbage a year out of the ravine. Now there's relatively little. We do collect several dozen garbage bags of waste from the ravine each year now, but it's much, much better than it was. And as they continued to work in the area, they also got involved in planting new trees in areas that didn't have good tree cover or were filled with invasive plants. So a lot of invasive English ivy and Himalayan blackberry have been removed from the ravine, and new trees have been planted, native trees like cedar and Douglas fir and other trees like that. So local schools got involved, and we started having regular meetups and also created a lot of art around the ravine to help draw attention. So if you walk around Renfrew Ravine, you'll actually come across many little artworks and curated gardens, kind of semi-wild garden areas that people can enjoy. Some of these were built before Still Moon, but Still Moon continues to tend to them and has created some new ones. So one example of this is there is a kind of round bench that is surrounded by a big mosaic that shows fish and eagles and other creatures in the ravine. There's also a large pebble labyrinth that is a popular landmark on the east side of the ravine, and that was created by Still Moon with neighbors and also by several years of children from the local schools who came and helped to create it. So various kind of little hidden treasures all through the ravine.
Do you think you could expand a bit on this idea of art playing a role in the conservation of and connection to our environment? Like, how does that work within Still Moon Arts Society?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we have kind of two prongs, I'd say, and again, they're kind of intertwined, but one is just making art that celebrates and draws attention to nature. So one project that we're working on this year is called Water Woman, and it's a giant puppet made of water-loving plants that are grown in the area and harvested from around the creek. Some of them are invasive, some of them are native. And we've worked with the community to both create the puppet and also her dress. And we've had over 1,000 people contribute to making this puppet. And I'll tell you a bit about the process, which I think will help answer the question. What we wanted to do was have a project which would encourage people to think about water, think about their relationship with water, because in our day-to-day life, a lot of people don't really think about it. And just like many natural processes and cycles, we can connect to these things just by stepping outside. And as long as we're able to see it, as long as we're kind of thinking to look and see and realize. And that can create a lot of comfort to kind of have this connection to something larger than yourself. So, you know, such as the land and water cycles. Water is obviously critical to our survival, but a lot of people don't really think about it. You know, you turn on the tap, you get water, but, and then, you know, you kind of worry that there may not be water, you know, with drought and climate change, but something that you kind of are in relationship with. A lot of us don't have that. And we wanted to kind of encourage people to explore that relationship and explore water as something that both they have a connection to, they value, they can protect it, and also it cares for them and it feeds them and nourishes them. So we started out by having some dialogue sessions with people from the community where we would have people talk about, we would have some speakers who would talk about water stories from their cultures or water experiences, their own experience with water, and kind of encourage people to reflect on that themselves. And then they would create a fabric swatch after or during the conversation where they would draw a symbol or a memory or an illustration, something to do with their experience with water and their connection to it. So we repeated this process a number of times, and we also brought in some local schools, and we ended up with over 700 of these fabric swatches that were decorated with designs and images and hopes and thoughts about water from, you know, the hundreds of people who took part in this process. And then we have sewn them together into a dress for a 3-meter tall puppet. The puppet herself, unlike most giant puppets, which are, you know, made from PVC pipe, things like that, our puppet is made from willow that was harvested around the neighborhood. So, which creates design challenges, but, you know, it's really interesting. And I would say fulfilling also to kind of work with a natural material, because by working with a natural material, you kind of learn about it in a way that you can't learn through reading books. You really get your hands on it. You learn its properties. You learn where it grows and, you know, how it bends and snaps and, you know, its different properties. So the puppet has a willow frame. We have the dress, and we also have the hands of the puppet are decorated with prayers for the water that have been written down by people who attend our annual festival over 10 years. And those are used to a sort of papier-mâché style over the hands. So you can't read exactly what it says, but the words are kind of there incorporated into her body. So, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people's of thoughts and reflections over many years actually have gone into making this puppet. And one of my favorite parts is, because I like to have something to do with my hands, is her hair is made of twined rushes and daylilies and other plant material. So we need hundreds of meters of this twine material. So we also have many volunteers who've been twining away, making cordage that will be her hair. So yeah, and she's going to have her inaugural performance at the Renfrew Marine Moo Festival. So what this project does is, through conversations and facilitated conversations, people have reflected on water and hopefully deepen their relationship with it, or at least, you know, spend some time thinking about the relationship with water. Also, when you see the puppet, you see how many people in the community, because it's, you know, it's large and it has all these elements from hundreds and hundreds of people. It kind of reminds you that you're not alone in kind of contemplating your place in the world and, you know, how the planet is faring these days. But, you know, you're surrounded by a whole community of people who are thinking the same things and worried about the same things and also appreciating the same things. I would say that, you know, appreciation of nature is something that crosses all cultures, and it really is great at bringing people together and uniting them. And then also we have, for this puppet, we'll have a movement performance. So we've We're recruiting, actually, right now we're recruiting seniors and children and everyone in between to be part of a performance at the Renfrew Ravine Moon Festival this year of the puppet. And I think it'll be quite spectacular because actually her head and her hands are both lanterns. The performance will be after dark, and she'll be wearing these flowing robes that are naturally dyed with local plants that will flow like water. And we'll also have people operating her heads and her hands, which will glow in the night. So, and yeah, so it also is creating an opportunity for people to come together and perform. And a lot of times too, we find people have conversations when they're working on these things about just, I guess, appreciating the natural world around them. Most of the work that we do is done outside, even our art workshops. So often it's just, being together, caring for things around you, and creating together is a great way to have a positive experience in nature. And again, a lot of what we're trying to do is create positive experiences, because there's a lot of anxiety these days, but, and I think well-placed, but we can also still take great nourishment and joy from being in nature. So that's one thing that we purposefully try and foreground in our work. So we do definitely laugh a lot. We like performances. We like spectacle. Like I said, we have our big annual festival, which is a lantern festival that celebrates nature and community. And, I think just finding regular opportunities to do joyful, creative, fun things in nature is one of the most healing ways to kind of strengthen your relationship with nature, is to make it a really positive experience.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been to the Renfrew Ravine Moon Festival, and it was quite the celebration. I had a great time. For our listeners, it is coming up in September, right? Could you tell them a little bit more about what it is?
Absolutely. So this year's festival will run from September 7 to the main day, with the big events on September 26th. The Renfrew Ravine Moon Festival is a celebration of harvest traditions, the different cultures of the people who live in Renfrew Collingwood, and art, music, and also celebrating nature around Still Creek. So at its heart is the lantern installation on the final day, which lights up the evening with all kinds of handmade lanterns. And leading up to that, we have a series of workshops, both on harvest themes, on nature themes, and always some lantern making workshops, so that everyone can get involved, make their own lanterns, learn about lantern making, which is super fun. And then we have a Equinox Labyrinth Walk, which has live music with it and is a kind of more meditative event to contemplate season change, with the beautifully decorated labyrinth next to Renfrew Ravine. And we have a vocalist showcase with music in the Dye Garden. And then the main day, with the lanterns at the end, actually starts in the afternoon at Slocan Park. We have a big party with great live music and art activities, and harvest soup for people to chow down on, and also opportunities to make a lantern at the festival. If you haven't yet, you can make one at the harvest fair. And when the sun sets, we transition to the twilight lantern procession. So everyone who's gathered at the harvest fair sets out to walk from Slocan Park along the edge of the Renfrew Ravine to Renfrew Community Park. It's about a 20-minute walk, with music and lanterns and costumes. And when we arrive at Renfrew Community Park, we find the whole park has been transformed by lanterns that line the stream banks and are set amongst the trees. We have also live music set among the trees. And as you walk along, it can be quite dark and disorienting. I remember the first time I went there, I couldn't even really tell how large a space it was because the paths crisscross over the creek and back again and go in circles. But it's really, really a surprise, I think, when you see it for the first time. I had been involved my first year here in planning it, but when I actually walked into the space, I had not at all expected what it would feel like to be there. And it really is a kind of magical and unique event. So it's a great way to mark the change of season. I know often people are sad to see summer go, but to celebrate that season change kind of reminds us to enjoy the beautiful fallen leaves and enjoy the coming change of season. Every season is a bit different, and it kind of is a chance to mark that season change and prepare to enjoy the winter and fall experiences that we have ahead of us.
Nice. Yeah. So I think for my final question, I just think our listeners would be curious themselves, because I mean, I'm also slightly curious about how to get involved with Still Moon Arts Society in terms of volunteering or just supporting.
This is a great time of year actually to get involved with Still Moon. We have events, several events every week at this time of year. Because the weather is nice, it's the best time to get things done. We have a lot of stewardship events right now. We have several events every week. Many of them are helping to remove invasive plants from various site locations along the creek. And often at those events, we also do art activities like making dyes with natural plants and then making paintbrushes, painting with them. Also things like twining, natural dyes. All of this is usually done with invasive plants we remove, which we're preparing now to plant in the fall. We prepare now by removing the invasive plants so that the ground has been prepared for lots of native plants to go in September, October, November. So we'll need help outdoors with our stewardship programming all through until mid-November, but lots of sessions now while the weather is still good, while everyone wants to get outside. We also have a new food forest program with our Indigenous partner, Leona Brown. So we started earlier this year a food forest at Renfrew Ravine Park, and we've also taken over helping with an existing food forest at Beaconsfield Park. So anyone who's interested in learning more about food forests, that's a great place to get involved. And the other thing we have going on right now is this giant puppet project that I was talking about earlier. So we've just opened registration for people who are interested in being part of the performance or interested in helping to make the puppet for the final stages. So the giant puppet creation will be going on mainly in August with a bit before and after. And the performance preparation will be in September. So those are open for sign up now. We do everything we do is only possible because of all the volunteers who join in. So really the best way is to help is to get involved in any one of these projects where we're all working together to get things done. Finally, I would say we also have volunteer openings for helping with the Renfrew Ravine Moon Festival. And it's a big festival with about 5,000 people attending every year. And we need a lot of help to get things done there. The jobs there are anything from helping to set up the lanterns to, working in a booth, selling t-shirts, to things like stage managers or helping people find their way at the festival. And we need several hundred volunteers every year to pull it off. And really, we would love to have volunteers of all ages, with experience or without, to help us get the festival done. And we have a gorgeous t-shirt by local mural artist Anaïs Lera to give to anyone who's able to volunteer this year. So yeah, those volunteer positions will start in about 2 weeks. So we'd love to Yeah, we'd love to have people help out. And I know in past years, we've often had lots of students from SFU. So yeah, you'll probably meet other people from SFU down in East Vancouver if you sign up to volunteer with us.
Nice. And you just signed up to volunteer online?
That's right. All these opportunities can be found via our website. We have an events section, volunteer opportunities, and a lot of our events are also on Eventbrite or on social media. You can follow us on Instagram at StillMoonArts is our handle. And yeah, or look for us on Instagram. Like I said, we also have an email newsletter if someone, for people who kind of want to make sure that they see everything that goes past, like all the opportunities. The newsletter is a great way to sign up. And most of our activities, I'll just kind of reiterate, they're free. You don't need a long-term commitment. And so if you're ever looking for anything to do on an evening or a weekend, you know, we may well have something happening for free with, you know, cool people to hang out with and skills to learn, either getting your hands dirty planting or gardening or making art. So yeah, I encourage people to just look it up at our website anytime they're looking for something to do.
That was the end of my interview with Clea. I highly encourage you to look into the Renfrew Ravine Moon Festival. And next up on Super Summer Programming is another interview. Stay tuned.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CGSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CGSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cgsf.ca.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Community Radio from Simon Fraser University. I'm Stella, the programming assistant at the station, and today I am here with Parmjot Gill, the owner of Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium, a historic 2S LGBTQIA+ institution in Davie Village, and Glenn Tkach, a storyteller of queer history. Together, they are putting on an upcoming event called Queer Confidential, Six True Stories of Queer Vancouver Before 1950. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, of course. And before we get into the interview, could you all just introduce yourselves a bit to CJSF's listeners?
After you, Glenn.
Go ahead, Parm.
Yeah, absolutely. So Parm Gill, as mentioned, owner and operator of Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium on Davie Street. I've spent the last 10, 15 years in the impact space, really getting behind passionate projects and teams that I believe in. And yeah, really excited to be taking Little Sisters into its next era.
And my name is Glenn. Hi, everyone. Hi, Stella. I am the creator of the Really Gay History Tour, which I lead every Sunday morning through the West End and Davie Village. And I also do storytelling events like the one that we're talking about today.
Nice. Thank you for those introductions. When I was first looking into the event and also just Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium in general, I kind of fell down, you know, like a Wikipedia rabbit hole. And I know that the store has quite the background battling for queer rights in Vancouver. And I was wondering if, you know, both of you could tell us a bit more about its history.
Yeah, I'm not surprised you fell down a rabbit hole, because it's a big story. And I think lots of members of the community are sort of aware of it. Lots of members of the community were very much involved in the fight. So some of your listeners may have gone to the bookstore back in its heyday. But in a nutshell, this bookstore opened in 1983. This was when the village was just emerging, and this was part of its emergence. So Little Sisters was kind of an early place on Davie Street in the early 80s that had an open queer presence but wasn't a bar, which made it significant because it was kind of it showed that there was a shift from just bar culture, like the closeted bar scene that had been around before in the 70s, to a more open, vibrant, like village cultural presence. And the bookstore signaled that. But it soon came under attack when Customs Canada started seizing materials aggressively and relentlessly at the border, and Little Sisters eventually pushed back, and that became that was the beginning of a big legal struggle that lasted for 15 years.
Yeah, thank you for that information, Parm. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, and I love how Glenn knows all these details. It's every time I speak to him, it's absolutely incredible to hear about the fascinating history of Little Sisters. So feeling very thankful to be on this call, like be on this with you, Glenn. I think for me, a couple of things about Little Sisters. Shortly after it did open its doors in 1983, that's when Customs Canada began seizing queer literature that was bound just for Little Sisters. And that it was on the grounds that all this material was labeled as obscene. This is also despite the fact that other large retailers were able to import similar books without issue. And so that's what Glenn touched on, is that the founders of Little Sisters and longstanding manager Janine Fuller went on that decade and a half long court case, which ultimately landed in a landmark ruling, which is fantastic. And so from that ruling to then going through the AIDS crisis and providing educational materials, because there's a lot of misinformation out there, Little Sisters has been really this community hub that has withstood the test of time. And so historically, what started off as a bookstore has become a community hub and an institution throughout these years. And during this time, it's quite interesting. During the court battles, the store was also the victim of three terrorist bombings. And I'm sure, Glenn, you'll have some more information about that as well. But very rich, very vibrant history. And it's a place that I would want to say, in terms of what it represents today, it's a place where if someone is looking to discover who they are, it's a place that you can go to. You can learn more about yourself, your sexuality, a place of sense of self-discovery.
Yeah, and I think it always has been that. I think that that's what one thing that made it so unique in the beginning was that this was a place. I mean, you have to try and imagine what it was like before we had an internet. And before there was even any kind of anything like the more widespread acceptance that there is for queer identity now. Like, it was queer identity was thoroughly stigmatized in this period, in the early 80s. So if you were a person growing up at this time and felt like there was something different about you, about your identity or about your attractions, you couldn't Google it up to see if there were other people like you, and books that might affirm you were not necessarily that easy to find. So Little Sisters really was a beacon. It was a place where you could learn about your identity. You could learn about yourself. Someone would be there. You could just walk in the door and be like, help. I need some guidance, and someone would guide you to the exact book. There were shelves and shelves of books about coming out or about navigating your identity in the context of your religion or spirituality or in the context of whatever you were going through in your life. And so someone would be there to guide you to the exact book that you needed. So it was really, it was kind of a de facto community center in a way. It was a way where you could get affirmation, you could see yourself reflected in literature. And as Parm has pointed out, it's kind of remained that. It remains a beacon of information and of community building. I should probably mention that what's important about the legal victory that Little Sisters won, and what makes it such an important, institution, not just in local history, but in Canadian history, is that the legal battle shifted at a certain point from being a harassment claim, like stop harassing us, to becoming much more significant. It became a charter challenge. Little Sisters pivoted their strategy and said, listen, what you're doing is actually against the law. You're not just pushing, like, you're not just misbehaving. The whole mandate of customs seizing materials that they think is obscene is inherently a violation of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So they ultimately took on the law itself. They said, your law, these lower laws are breaking higher laws, and this needs to be fixed. So they were taking on federal law. And in the end, I mean, it's a long story. It's a whole, as you probably discovered during your Wikipedia rabbit hole deep dive, I'm very much simplifying it here. But in the end, at the level of the Supreme Court of Canada, they won. And that is a landmark victory. That makes a difference for all Canadians. That limits the government's ability to censor what we read and what we look at. Not just queer people, but all Canadians have their rights and freedoms more secured in the law as a result of this victory.
Yeah, totally. It has been such a struggle to create these spaces and conversations where queer voices and identities are heard, and the queer community continues to uplift their own community and create these spaces. I'm glad that, Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium is also a community hub. And Glenn, you already touched on this a bit, but I was wondering, why is it necessary for people to have access to queer literature across all different genres?
Yeah, and you're right. I touched on it a bit, but I'm happy to delve into it more. I think that there's power in seeing ourselves represented in literature. Obviously, I'm a storyteller and historian, so I can't help but think about how meaningful it is for us to see ourselves reflected in history, that we didn't just arrive, like we didn't just show up in the 1970s. This isn't a weird cultural phenomenon that's like constrained only to this, like to the late 20th century in the Western world. There is a deep and longstanding like historical presence, and I think for queer people who have had their, I guess, histories deleted and erased, being able to have a sense of lineage, like you belong to a tradition, and that you have heroes, and that there are you know, sort of forebears who came before you, that's meaningful. That's an important part of culture build, or identity building, that helps you understand who you are in the context of a bigger story. So these things are a really important part of wholeness and of belonging. But of course, we also live in a culture where queer identity is persecuted. So having the resources to be able to navigate that kind of persecution, how to stay whole, how to be politically active, all those things, like all of this information, is extremely important for queer people to have access to.
Yeah, definitely. And I'd be curious to hear your thoughts as well, Parm, as the owner of Little Sisters.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my first thought was isolation. It's, you know, when you're isolated and you're alone, you don't have access to information that can get you out of that space. That's a really scary space to be. And when you think about being queer in general, particularly if you think about smaller or more conservative communities, you might not have access to in-person community around you that identifies as queer. So having access to a library, a bookstore, information helps open up a queer culture, history, world to you. And it helps you when you're sort of figuring yourself out and going through a bit of a struggle. I think one of the things that Glenn touched on that I do want to dig into a little bit more is really around censorship. So at the end of the day, if you are censoring literature, you're all that belongs to the queer histories and stories and cultures of a certain people, you are also censoring them in society. So it is saying that if you are censored here, you're censored in society, and society doesn't necessarily have a place for you because these are our values and beliefs. And what this was representative of is that this is not society's values and beliefs, and that it, quite the contrary, that our society has amazing values and beliefs. And for me, I always think that I'm so thankful that I grew up and we live in Canada, that this is a place where we value people for who they are. We stand up and fight for our rights and freedoms and for the diversity of the communities that we live in. And so I would say that those were probably the two big things for me in this, above and beyond what one said.
Yeah. Definitely. And there is like an increase in the oppression and suppression of queer voices right now. And I was wondering, like, what does the fight for queer visibility mean to both of you?
This is something I think I feel like we as a community are really lucky that we have someone like Parm, who has now taken on who recently acquired the business and who's really interested in carrying on the legacy of Little Sisters, and who is deeply invested in its history and wants to carry that torch forward, but also kind of like reinvent it for modern times, because we're, you know, it's the 2020s are different than the 1980s. There is the dynamics of the community have changed, the dynamics of the village have changed, the dynamics of our oppression have changed. So I think I'm in my dialogues with Parm, I'm really inspired about how he wants to Little Sisters to maintain the position that it's always held in the community, but adapt to modern times. And so it's one of the reasons why we've talked about having these storytelling events at Little Sisters, because Little Sisters has always been a place of story. It's been a place where we've been able, and traditionally that was through books, but the modern world has changed that. There's more accessibility to books elsewhere now, and even online. But a place where we can come together as a community, which is what Little Sisters always was a community hub, and to gather around the idea of our stories and our identities. And as we dialogued, this struck both of us as an important way of being able to kind of carry the torch forward in a way that makes more sense for modern times, in a way that helps that inspires community members to come out and still gather, because I think that's such an important part of it. I think that online life and social media has a way of reinforcing our sense of isolation, and it gives us the illusion of community, like, ooh, we can build online communities by tweeting around or whatever, but it's not the same as gathering together in the same room and feeling that kind of solidarity that happens when people are together. So this is a big part of why we want to do the storytelling event that we're here to talk about today.
Oh, beautifully spoken, Glenn. I'll add a couple of things. And, you know, when I think about online, anonymity has safety sometimes. It also has challenges. So how can you explore yourself online and see what's out there? But what we find online, there are communities, but it's a different way of connecting and engaging. And the great thing about Little Sisters, it's really about humanization. It's about humanizing community, finding a center place where we can meet. And really, at the end of the day, when I look at Little Sisters and what it represents, this isn't just a business, you know, this is something that we are stewarding into its next era. Little Sisters has historically been a bookshop. We sell a wide range of products. It's been a place of community gathering, of storytelling, of sharing narrative. It's also a place that has a lot of rich history. And so stewarding that into its next era, where a place that's created movements that have gone across the country to uphold rights across country, it is a really tough thing to do. It is, especially in the challenging retail space that we're in. And so, you know, I feel very fortunate when I have someone like Glenn, who's a partner here, who says, hey, let's sit down, let's really double down on community and bring community back into Little Sisters. And so a big focus for us really moving forward with Little Sisters is re-engaging with the community and centralizing it in a very big ways. And so this is one part of a multiple storyteller series that we'll be engaging in. And so I'm really excited to kick this one off with Glenn, because I think that this is a great way to touch base on our histories while modernizing the story and bringing it forward into its future.
Yeah, totally. And we will get into talking about the event shortly, but I just want to know a little bit more about you two before that. And specifically, Parm, I was curious, what brought you to buying and investing in Little Sisters?
Yeah, absolutely. So by way of background, I'm an impact entrepreneur, venture capitalist. Venture capitalists, by the way, get a pretty bad rap, to be very clear. Yes, there's a financial capital component to it, and I work in the impact space. So I get behind technologies, companies, and people that I believe in. And so when I talk about this, it's clean technology. How do you make the environment a better place while at the same time optimizing for profitability? So I also have been a part of Queer Business BC. When the organization sunsetted operations 4 or 5 years ago, formerly known as Loud Business, used to be the thriving heart of the queer business community all across I would say British Columbia. And so I put my hand up to reorganize and rechapter the organization in very big ways. And over the course of 4 or 5 years, we've grown to over 100 plus membership, full-time employee. And what we really have is our finger on the pulse in terms of what the community needs. Everything from networking, mentorship opportunities, and at the same time, we hear about what's happening in the community that we live in. And so when Little Sisters came up for sale, I, as the chair of Queer Business BC, heard about it. And what I had also heard was that there's a potential that, you know, this might be rehomed to someone who may or may not be in the community. And that's what got my blinders, or my you know, the red flag going. To be very clear, that was what drew me in, because I had been to Little Sisters years and years ago when I was trying to figure out my identity, when I came out as a gay man. All roads led me to Little Sisters. And so I remember coming into the shop a few times, and at some point someone said, sweetie, do you need some help? And sort of ran away, came back. And then one day I said, yes, I do need some help, please. And so I remember that feeling. And so there's a sense of this place, this institution, the work that it does in helping people discover themselves. It's too important for it to not stay queer, own and operate, but also it's too important for there not to be a steward for what this represents, bringing it into its next era. And so I started to engage with the previous owner. It was Don and Verna who bought it from Jim and Bruce back in 2014. Don had passed away, and his sister Verna came in, and honestly, incredible human being. She believes in the community, wanted to rehome it to the community. And that was my first sort of ray of sunshine in this, because I was like, you are looking for that next queer steward. Let's talk. And so I spent about 6 months working on figuring out the business, laying out a strategy, a map, and really figuring out how to get it through its next era. And for retail space, there are challenges. We're also heading into a space with the store where outside of the store, there's going to be construction for up to 2 years. And 40% of businesses on Davie Street suffered massive losses or shut down. And so we're going into an era where I've had this tight window for about 3 to 4 months to really get the business to where it needs to get to make sure that we are engaging with the community, that obviously our operations are cleaned up, and at the same time that we're scaling our e-commerce to also offset any revenue loss that we have so that we can continue to sustain operations and really maintain the role that we have in the community. There's been a lot of work that's gone into that, and I'm happy to touch on that at another point. But, you know, just to summarize, I got involved because I care. I heard that this you know, I think that there's been this amazing queer history to Little Sisters, and I wanted to take that forward in a very big way.
Yeah, that's definitely great to keep it in the community, and especially, like, by someone who cares so much and has this emotional significance and passion for it, and that's great. And turning over to Glenn, as a historian and storyteller, what is the significance of art archiving and passing along queer knowledge and history to you?
As I said before, I think that we have, as a community, sort of have a deficit in understanding what our history is. And it's kind of a double punch because we have been scrubbed so thoroughly from, like, in the Western world, we've been scrubbed. Queerness, queer identity has been erased from our large community histories, our ethno-religious histories and stuff like that. So the communities, the ethnic communities or the other, like, communities that we belong to really lack any sense of queer identity. Because of that, we've been forced to create our own subculture. And that's something that happened in the 20th, especially in the late 20th century. But even the history of that culture is kind of invisible. Nobody knows it because we are a minority group. We're a person. So that, like, there's just not really any, like, there aren't sufficient resources there or interest by, you know, institutions or whatever to record and preserve our history. So even in our own community, we don't know what our history is. As I said before, I think that knowing what your history is a big part of forming your own identity. I think all of us build our identities to some extent through a dialogue between who we feel we are inside and what our outer world is telling, is mirroring back to us. And if you lack part of that, it can really, like, screw up your sense of how to build an identity. And so I think I went through a transformation myself when I started delving into these histories to create the walking tour. I knew they would be incredible stories. I was curious to learn them. I don't think I fully anticipated or realized the impact that it would have on me as a person. It transformed me. It is not an exaggeration to say that creating the tour really changed my life, because it really helped me to understand my own role in the larger story and how to fit into my own lineage. I did not know what I was missing. And I think that guests on the tour and guests at the storytelling events that I've done over the years often come to me with a similar response, so that not really having never known what our stories are. I think all of us can sort of vaguely say, oh yeah, there was a struggle and people marched or whatever, there were pride parades, and now things, like, people have a vague understanding that there was a struggle, but that is not the same thing as understanding in detail what those struggles were, who fought them, who our heroes are, and what they were like, and what exactly they went through to pave the way for where we're at right now.
Really important and crucial work that both of you are doing, and you've been giving each other some flowers throughout the interview, which I love to see, but I was wondering, why did you choose to collaborate with one another to host Queer Confidential?
Yeah, if anyone wants to know anything about queer history, you know, I would say, let me put it this way. When you're trying to figure out your sense of self, or go through a sense of self-discovery, figure out your identity, all roads lead to Little Sisters. If you want to know anything about queer history, especially in British Columbia, all roads lead to Glenn. And so, you know, I've been on this tour with my partner, and, you know, I was just inspired by the way that, you know, Glenn, you care, it comes through, you do your work in ways that I don't think anyone else in British Columbia has access to knowledge and information, and the way that you are able to articulate your stories, I find them inspiring. And so when I think of sort of the values of Little Sisters for community and engagement and dialogue, I think you naturally represent them just by who you are. And so I was drawn in by the stories, and personally. I think Glenn has been a strong advocate and a strong supporter of the community for years in the biggest way possible. And so there was actually no choice but to work with Glenn, given who he is as a person. And so for me, yes, we've been given flowers, but I do feel so privileged to be able to doing this with you. There are very few other people I'd want to kick off series like this with as sort of the first, but I appreciate you going on this with me. It's really excited.
I appreciate that, Parm. And I think likewise, I mean, it's Little Sisters is such a meaningful place because it is a place of story. Like we discussed before, this is where people have historically gone to see themselves reflected in stories, whether those are like true stories, autobiographies, or whether even in fiction. But Little Sisters has a sense of queer story at its heart, but it is also a landmark historical site. Obviously, it's a major stop on my walking tour. A walking tour of Vancouver's queer history would be unthinkable if you did not include Little Sister in it. So it's obviously a stop in the tour. It's a feature of the tour. It's the one stop on the tour that many people already know about by the time they arrive, because it is such a it's such an important part of our local and national history. So for me to be able to be there, and like it just seemed like a natural synergy, a place of story and a place of history. That's where I want to be, sharing the history. I think that's where the community should be gathering to hear its history and to hear its stories.
Yeah, and this all leads me to the question of, can you tell our listeners about your upcoming event, when it is, where it is, what it is?
So Queer Confidential, as you mentioned at the start, is six true stories of Vancouver queer history dating back to the 1950s and earlier, which is such a fascinating period of queer history to explore, because people know more about what happened more recently in the late 20th century, ever since decriminalization and ever since queer liberation. There's been more documented. And some of the elders who fought through those times are still alive. But there's a real curtain before that, beyond which it's hard to gather information. It's hard to, like, lots of histories have been erased. So it's really, that's a period that I'm really interested in, because it shows that there has always been queer identity. There's always been queerness in the culture, even when there was less permission for it, or even before there were names, words with which to identify it. So it's hard to find that kind of information, but I found some, and I'm really keen to be able to share it. Some of these are things that came up during my original research for the tour that just couldn't fit within the 2-hour time frame, or couldn't fit on the route. Stories that came up in my research that this is like the B-roll or the B-side of the tour. Stories that didn't quite make it onto the tour, but are equally powerful, equally remarkable, and stories that I think people in our community should know.
Yeah, so I hope I don't get this wrong. It's August 27th. From 7 to 8 p.m. And anyone who comes in and shops with an active ticket also gets 10% off in store at the same time. So after 8 p.m., there'll be a period of where there's a little bit of mingling. And so it'll be nice to see it and to speak to some other people in the room. And Glenn will still be here. So I'm sure if there are any follow-up questions, it'd be a good time to ask.
Nice. And where do people buy tickets?
Absolutely. So we have a link on our Instagram in the bio. So Little Sisters CA. If you go to our Instagram, click on the link in the bio, it'll take you to a link to our website, and you can buy your tickets directly from there. To note, we had great reception. Almost half the tickets sort of flew off the shelves within a few days. And so there are a handful of tickets left. So if anyone is interested, I would highly recommend picking up tickets. We do have limited capacity for this event, so it is capped. And so, there are tickets available right now. Not sure if they'll be there in a couple of days.
Yeah, totally. I will also add the link for when I post this episode to buy tickets. And you said there's also a series that you're planning on doing?
Yeah. And so details, we're working through the details of this, but it's a series. There's so much rich culture and history, and really talking about that and creating dialogue around it is really important. And so this is our first kickoff event. And after, so far it's we've had great uptake for it. And if the uptake for this continues this way, it'll be a series. And so in terms of the series, we'll be working with Glenn on it. We'll also be looking to do a couple of different types of series outside of a storyteller series based off of some of the events that we've had requests for. as well. So anything around sex coaching, figuring out self-identity, and anything from a Shibari class or two as well. So there'll be some fun things happening at Little Sisters. This will be the first and hopefully something that we do on a regular basis.
That's great. And Glenn, you're doing your Really Gay History Tour every week?
That's right. The Really Gay History Tour runs every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. I also do private bookings for groups if anyone wants to reach out to do a private booking. I bring queer history like this directly into companies and businesses. So anyone who wants to hire me for Pride education or for Lunch and Learns or that kind of thing can find my website, which is thepinkhat.ca. If you want to go to the walking tour, then you can go to forbiddenvancouver.ca and book your tickets there or reach out about a private booking.
That concludes my interview with Parm and Glenn. If you're interested in buying a ticket to Queer Confidential, Six True Stories of Queer Vancouver Before 1950, I will be posting this episode on cjsf.ca along with the link to buy tickets. It is on August 27th, which is a Thursday, from 7 to 8 p.m.
Listen to Home of Burnaby Rock, CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.